This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The departure of U.S. Senator Rob Portman from the 2022 election cycle opens up lots of possibilities for other candidates in Ohio, clearing a path in that race for both Republicans and Democrats. So we start the weekly news review with Inquirer reporter Scott Wortman. Scott, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure to have you. We're also joined by Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Chris, thanks for coming back on.
Thanks for having me.
And you, if you're listening, can join our conversation at 513-419-7100 or email your comments, your questions, your thoughts to talk at WVXU.org. Scott Wortman, Rob Portman has decided not to seek another term, and he was up for re-election in 2022. He's only 65 years old, a mere whippersnapper in the United States Senate. So what was his reasoning that he offered up publicly?
Well, he just said that it's getting too bitter in Washington, D.C., that Republicans and Democrats can't work together, and it's just hard to get anything done. And so he just seemed frustrated and just wanted to come back home and spend time with his at his family's business. They own the Golden Lamb in Lebanon, Ohio, and go back in the private practice and just spend more time at home.
So a lack of bipartisanship, a lack of civility in the halls of Congress is not so unusual. Did the Senator Scott say anything in particular about this era, this particular moment in time that is different than those in the past?
Well, I asked him about that, and I mean, everyone pretty much asked him about that. He said Donald Trump didn't help, but I mean, for the last 4 years, he's played a delicate dance with the commander in chief, not wanting to strongly criticize President Trump, but, you know, occasionally differing with him. But he said that this has been happening for decades. So, I mean, he didn't lay the blame on President Trump. He just said in his announcement on Monday that President Trump didn't help, but he didn't blame Trump specifically.
Chris Wetterich is also with us from the Business Courier. Rob Portman, as recently as, I don't know, about 8 or 9 years ago, was on the shortlist for Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney to be a potential vice presidential running mate. So he was a national office contender. Is this the end of his political career, do we think, then, with him not seeking the U.S. Senate seat?
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering, is he going to wait tables at the Golden Lamb? I'm curious what his role will be there. No, just kidding. I think it pretty much is. I think I read in one of the national publications, I'm not quite sure which, so I apologize for not having a source on it, but somebody wrote that he did not rule out running for president in 2024. It's hard to imagine that. Rob Portman doesn't seem the type of person to run for president necessarily. You know, he's always been a kind of an inside player, always working on legislation behind the scenes, trying to be bipartisan at times. So I think it's probably the end, but you know, you never say never, I suppose, in politics.
So we've got a new president in Washington, D.C., so you can and new control, Democratic control in the halls of Congress. Both houses there are controlled by the Democrats. So we should see Rob Portman making some serious and consequential votes on some serious legislation that's expected to emerge. But most immediately, former President Trump still faces a trial in the impeachment process there. It's now in the hands of the United States Senate. Chris, what do we know about Senator Portman's position on whether he should vote to convict the former president?
Well, he was on the phone with reporters before the vote to, you know, continue or have the trial. And of course, he voted against that. He told us he was struggling with whether or not he, you know, whether you could try a former president when, I mean, there is plenty of precedent in the U.S., you know, U.S. history of trying former officials for, you know, to try and giving them impeachment trials after and so that seemed a little, that was interesting. Obviously, people took it as a sign that he is not going to vote to convict and that the only five Republicans are going to think about doing that. He tells us, though, that he will consider all of the evidence. But, you know, I think that initial procedural vote was a really telling one. And I suspect, you know, he also said that You know, he wants to cast a vote that would heal the nation, or that would look to bring the nation together. And, you know, he said that while that would be a political thing, he believes impeachment is a political process. So I kind of think he signaled where he's going on that. But nevertheless, he said he will consider all the evidence.
That's Chris Wedderk from The Business Courier. We're also joined via Zoom by Scott Wortman from The Inquirer. And Scott, on that point that the senator was making, that he views this as a political proceeding, how did he rationalize that with his pursuit of whether this process of moving to impeach and convict a president who is no longer in office and its constitutionality?
Well, he just said that it's a political process, and that is a valid criteria to use in making a decision that you know, what he sees as what's best for the country is should play a factor in whether he convicts a former president.
Scott, what do we know about what's next beyond working at the Golden Lamb in Lebanon? I guess, is he just going to settle into retirement?
I mean, he wouldn't say specifically. That's what it seemed to be his plans. But I mean, you know, I can't say what's in his mind. His wife, Jane, at his announcement on Monday, said that they'd been talking about this for quite some time, was the way she phrased it. He could be retiring right now, and this might be it.
Scott,
hey Scott.
Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
I was just wondering, I mean, you guys had it in your story that he had bought 100 acres in Warren County. Did he go into any detail what that was for?
No, I do not know any details. I've not been to his homestead out there, so I don't know if he's got a farm operation out there or not.
You did describe him in the article as an avid outdoorsman, Scott, and referencing that he and his wife had bought this 100-acre farm in Warren
Correct.
County last year. So they have plenty of land to spend their time on if this is retirement for them. What did the senator say, Scott, about now that the seat is open? Does he support any particular Republican successor?
Well, he also did not make any definitive statements on that. Very general, there are a lot of good candidates, but no, he did not intimate, you know, who he thought should be a successor, which when he first announced he was running for Senate in 2010, his predecessor, George Voinovich, most definitely singled out Portman as, you know, his preferred candidate, but Portman has not done any such thing during his retirement.
Chris, you explored some potential names that might be on that list of candidates coming out, and you made an interesting note in the commentary that you wrote at the Business Courier that the history of top Republican office holders in Ohio is filled with business-friendly establishment types. We think of people like George Voinovich, Bob Taft, John Kasich, Mike DeWine, and of course, Rob Portman. But the state of Ohio went for Donald Trump in both of his presidential elections, and there are certainly some Trump-esque firebrand political figures emerging in the Buckeye state. We did see reports that Congressman Jim Jordan, who is a big fan of the former president in the halls of Congress, that he's probably not or is not running for the Republican nomination for Senate in 2022. But what are you seeing in terms of the whispers that are happening about who might be taking a look at it?
Yeah, Jim Jordan taking a pass is huge because I think he would have been the front runner for this seat. You know, he's very much a supporter of Trump, but unlike, say, Jim Renacci, the former congressman who had run for the Senate against Sherrod Brown in 2018, he's Trump-like in the way that he acts. And you know, he's got, you know, he's enthusiastic. You know, he just really fits the mold of a Trump-like politician in this state. And for him to take a pass, you know, it is kind of really shakes up the race in a way. Now you have a lot of establishment people. I mean, anybody who is in Congress, anybody who has held state office in Ohio as a Republican, I think they just all are taking a really close look at it. I think Jane Timken, the GOP chair, I think she's an interesting candidate because she has relations, good relations with kind of the establishment side of the party, but she's very know, she's very heavily liked by the president, the former president himself. I mean, you know, her ascension to the chair of the party was driven by Trump himself, at least partly. And so, you know, I think she could be a very, very formidable candidate. And, you know, she's kind of Trump adjacent, right? She's not solely of the establishment. She's got both kind of pedigrees. And with the Democrats looking, you know, I think hoping that Dr. Amy Acton, the former health director, gets into the race on their side, that would be a really, really interesting matchup. Really kind of a, you know, a fun house for reporters as we, you know, go forward covering the race.
Well, Chris,
the other guy, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I know we're going to talk about a local Republican that's giving a look at this race. But as far as the Democrats go, since you referenced Dr. Amy Acton, the former health director who stepped down after reports that, you know, she had been threatened and this was quite a difficult job during the coronavirus pandemic. It's not out of the realm of possibility that Ohio voters would send a Democrat to the United States Senate. They've done it multiple times for Sherrod Brown. Are there any more, I guess, brand name Democrats that we're hearing about possibly taking a look at this? Or do you expect that there will be an outside candidate like Dr. Acton?
You know, I think we could. The two that come to mind, of course, are Representative Tim Ryan from the Youngstown area. He's considered statewide office a number of times. And, you know, he's kind of always been at the altar, but never really gone through with it. And then Mayor Nan Whaley of Dayton, you know, very popular mayor in Dayton. And, you know, she kind of comes from the, you know, the part of the state that Trump voters kind of coalesced around. You know, she's from a blue collar part of Ohio. And I think she could be very, very formidable as well. So.
And you're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks, joined today on the Weekly News Review by Scott Wortman from the Cincinnati Inquirer and Chris Wetterich from the Business Courier. Chris, you did talk about, or write about, a local Republican, a young guy who is possibly taking a look at this as a possible run for the Senate seat.
Yeah, this is kind of a out of right field candidate. His name is Vivek Ramaswamy. He's about 35 and he's a St. Xavier High School graduate. He's got a biology degree from Harvard and a law degree from Yale. And so he and his wife, they own a house in Butler County, and he recently stepped down as CEO of the biotech company that he started, that he helped found. And, you know, the other thing about him is his net worth is pretty significant. He was the founder and executive chairman of Roviant Sciences. In Forbes in 2016, they estimated that his net worth was $600 million. So he's got a potential self-funding situation. Talked to him Friday. He said he's flattered by people talking about him. No decision yet, of course. But he's, you know, he's gotten some national plays, written some op-eds in the Wall Street Journal, and he's been on Fox News a lot. So, you know, he's got kind of that Republican brand that might be, you know, that might be good for this seat. But it's clearly a name that people don't know. And, you know, he faces quite a heavy lift to get to the point where people would know him and potentially vote for him.
Scott, this is an election for the U.S. Senate in 2022, taking place alongside a race for governor. Republican incumbent Mike DeWine would be eligible to run again. But do we know whether this shakes up the race on the Democratic side as these candidates look at their options now?
The Portman race shaking up the gubernatorial race?
Sure.
It's too early to say on that. It doesn't seem like candidates that were committed to running for governor are jumping race yet. John Cranley just recently said he's announced he's interested in running for governor. He's not interested in Portman's seat. I mean, I don't know, Chris, if you've heard anything different, but I think it's a little too early. It's just speculation as far as how that affects the gubernatorial race. One thing I can say, now that I think of it, a lot of the Trump Republicans that I've talked to that are dissatisfied with DeWine, that didn't really carry over to Portman and Portman's Senate seat. There was a lot more interest in primarying DeWine from the Republican side, I can say. But as far as the Democratic side, I haven't heard anything. Have you, Chris?
Not really. I mean, there's two schools of thought on it. I mean, there's the school of thought that Mike DeWine can breathe a sigh of relief because it'll just be a feeding frenzy for an open Senate seat. That's very difficult to knock off an incumbent governor. Unless the former president came out and said and endorsed somebody against DeWine, I think it's just a very, very uphill battle. On the other hand, you know, maybe there's one person who's looking at the Senate race and saying, okay, I don't need to be in this pack. I'm going to, you know, kind of zig when everybody else is zagging and I'm going to go run against DeWine. So, I mean, it's a mixed bag, I think, and only time will tell.
Well, governorship and a Senate seat are two completely different offices with a lot of different responsibilities. So it can appeal to a completely different type of candidate.
Well, before we even get to 2022, we've got to get through 2021, and we do have a pretty important local election in the city of Cincinnati, and that is the race for mayor. Of course, John Cranley exploring a run for governor, not eligible to run for another term as mayor, and my goodness, the field grows with every passing week, and it's not just candidates that are coming from the outside. There are a lot of high-profile names here. I should start with the note that a couple of high-profile names that had been tossed around as potential candidates, former Mayor Mark Mallory, former councilman and Hamilton County Commissioner and Democratic Party Chair David Pepper, have left the race or have ruled out entering the race. Chris, tell us a little bit about their reasoning there.
Well, in Mallory's case, he said he had other priorities. Not really sure what those are, but I think that he had kind of, it's kind of a loop, you know, in terms of his decision-making. I feel like he was, more excited about the possibility when he announced that he was going to get signatures back in December. And, I think his enthusiasm kind of waned as, the field has grown and, you have basically three city council members at this point. Could add more, former state or current state senator Cecil Thomas, and you've got the county clerk of courts Aftab Pureval. When I looked at this race, I kind of viewed the big four as being Commissioner Denise Driehaus, Aftab Pureval, Mallory, and Pepper, just because they have all won city or county office in a head-to-head race, unlike any of the other candidates in the field. And I thought that, you know, if one of them did it, the other three would be more unlikely to do it. And I think that's kind of where we are at this point. David Pepper, I didn't speak to him directly. We had sources that told us that he was out. I think the Inquirer did get a hold of him. So I'm not sure what his reasoning is. He would have had to move into the city. He does not currently live in the city. So that's always an obstacle. And that's kind of a hassle to do, especially with the short timetable that we are in, where you have to gather signatures by mid-February.
Similarly to the U.S. Senate race, Chris, you wrote about an upstart candidate on the Republican side exploring a possible race, and you've also profiled a similar situation involving the mayor's race. What can you tell us about Gavi Bechtrop?
Yeah, Mr. Bechtrop is the former CEO of a startup that has kind of gone out of business called Ekron Systems. And he's at the point where he's already gathered signatures. I believe he has qualified for the ballot. He's an interesting guy. He's a physicist by trade. He kind of says he's running for mayor because the city is he doesn't think it's living up to its potential and needs a person with his skill set to kind of lead it. He's also got political experience in that he was an advisor to Representative Gabrielle Giffords, who, of course, is known for the attempted assassination on her in 2011. He was kind of a science advisor to her and the committee, the subcommittee that she ran. They did, did things like dealing with NASA's budget. And so he's got some interesting experience that kind of departs from the rest of the people in the field.
When should we expect this field to be stabilized and we'll know who's on that ballot?
I don't think we'll know absolutely for any certainty before, and I want to say the filing date is February 18th, but I think I may be wrong. I'm not sure, but it's mid-February. And, I don't, we could have people filing at the last minute who we didn't even anticipate being there. So I don't expect any stability until that point.
That's Chris Wederick from the Business Courier. We're also joined by Scott Wortman from the Cincinnati Inquirer. Scott, a very interesting rule, law in the state of Ohio related to county treasurer position. And we're learning about that in part thanks to your writing about it. there's a weird vacancy now in the position in Hamilton County. Can you let us know about it?
Yeah, and I think it kind of took even the next treasurer a little by surprise. The current treasurer, Robert Goring, he is one of the last three Republicans that in Hamilton County that still hold countywide office. He won a judgeship, which their term on the Court of Common Pleas starts February 11th. But because of some quirk in state law, and I've not had anyone explain the origins of it, but I suspect it probably has to do with like when tax bills go out. County treasurers statewide, according to state law, don't take office till September. So that leaves 6 months where Hamilton County is treasureless. So because the current treasurer is a Republican and the next treasurer, which is Hyde Park Democrat Jill Schiller, leaves an interesting political situation because when there's a vacancy, it falls to that candidate's party to appoint the successor. So Republicans are looking for someone a Republican who's interested in collecting taxes for 6 months.
And Jill Schiller, the Democrat who won the election over Charlie Winburn back in November, a very close race, she's got a suggestion on who should be appointed, right?
Yep, her. And I called Alex Triantafila. I mean, basically, Jill Schiller said that this would be a great show of bipartisanship. Hey, let's unite the country. The Hamilton County GOP leader, Alex Triantafila, he didn't respond to my calls on that, but then tweeted out later that, nope, the Republicans are not going to appoint a Democrat.
Well, we'll continue to watch that. Before we let you all run, Scott, a quick update on the observation wheel that was supposed to come back to the bank, SkyStar. I think last time you were on, just before our winter break, this was still happening, and now we're seeing this possibly not happening?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to gauge the state of the Ferris wheel industry right now, but the county leaders in December were hopeful that, yeah, whenever this clears up, the pandemic, the giant Ferris wheel that was glowing on the riverfront for 18 months, I believe it was, something about thereabouts, will come back. But they got an email from the head of the company that says that, you know, we still want you to keep that open, but don't wait up for us. If you find a better use for that spot, by all means. So that doesn't sound too optimistic. I mean, you know, I can't say what's in his mind, but who knows?
Well, there was a time where we were thinking we were going to have two observation wheels, one at the banks and one at Newport on the Levee, and now they both seem questionable at this point, but I'm sure you will continue to monitor this developing situation for us, Scott, and bring us the very latest the next time we're able to have you on. Scott Wartman from the Cincinnati.
24/7, I'm going to be on it.
I love it. Scott Wartman from the Inquirer, Chris Wederick from the Business Courier, thanks so much for the time you gave us today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks
for having me.
Have a great weekend. Up next, a man charged in the murder of a Northern Kentucky couple evades justice after contracting COVID-19 in jail and dying. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Florence couple Robert Jones and Crystal Warner were shot and killed more than 4 years ago. A tenant renting a property from them was arrested and charged in the murders, but he won't face a trial after getting COVID in jail and dying. The Weekly News Review continues now with Inquirer reporter Cameron Knight. Cameron, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you. You did a deep dive on this very tragic case. This is a man named Craig Pennington who had rented from this couple, Robert Jones and Crystal Warner, and was charged in their deaths. But he ultimately contracted COVID-19 while awaiting trial in jail. He was being held on $2 million bond, and he died. You spoke to some family members of the two victims. What did they have to say about the role his death plays in their pursuit of justice?
Well, I spoke to the sister of Robert Jones, who said she feels like the justice system kind of let her down. She felt like the process was taking far too long. It was just disheartening for her, I think, more than anything else. She feels that not only she said she feels like he got away with murder, and she also felt like some of the people that were also staying at the house may or may not have been involved in some way, and that should have been examined more thoroughly as well.
Well, take us and our listeners back to how this case first broke. We know some of the details about Jones and Wagner, and they had gone down to Washington Sure. County, Kentucky, to speak with Pennington. He was apparently late on some rent payments.
Yeah, there was some dispute over rent, and you know, on the other side of things, Pennington said that Jones was behind on the mortgage payments, so he felt like he was going to have to move. So the two had some financial disputes going on. Then after they went down there, they vanished. After about a week, their car was located, and police began suspecting that something might have happened. And then in the middle of the night, around midnight, a 19-year-old man who would have been considered Pennington's stepson, who lived at the house there, went to police and admitted that, and told them that not only did he witness Pennington kill the couple, that he also was forced and threatened to help Pennington hide the bodies. He told police in a very long interview, and that's all described in court documents. My reporting is all based on these court documents, that he saw what happened. That Pennington threatened him at first because he didn't want him to say anything. Then, you know, minutes or maybe several hours later, he came back to the 19-year-old and said, "You're going to help me or I'm going to hurt your family." So they went to a local Walmart. The teen said that he was forced to buy several gallons of bleach. And then he was told to wait in a McDonald's parking lot while Pennington drove off with two bodies in Crystal's Passat, her Volkswagen Passat. Apparently, according to the teen, there was a body in the trunk and a body in the back seat, and he drove away. Hours later, he comes back and has the teen buy him some food, again, according to court documents, and he and then they crafted a story to tell police. But then a week later, the teen went to police himself again at midnight with several of his relatives and decided to confess to his role and to point the finger at Pennington. The bodies weren't found for months. It took months for the bodies to be found.
And they were in separate locations.
Yeah, Robert's body was found in a neighboring county about a month later. And then Crystal's body was found almost 4 months or 5 months later, almost 100 miles away from Springfield, Kentucky, where this incident all allegedly took place.
What do we know about the relationship between this couple and this man who was charged in their killing? Was it just a tenant and landlord situation? Do we know the origins of that relationship?
I mean, I got the sense that it was from the court documents, it mentions that it was kind of a family property. Beyond that, it just seemed like they were renting, and that was about it. There were other people in the home. So there was Pennington, there was his longtime girlfriend and her children. One of those children is the 19-year-old who confessed to police. And then there were some people, sort of other people kind of attached to the family as well, that were all living there. But yeah, beyond that, there was not a whole lot of other connection besides this tenant relationship. It also was just this past week, Pennington's lawyer came forward and said that his client denied killing Robert and Crystal until he died.
And it was interesting because you talked to this attorney, and the attorney says that had the evidence been placed before a jury, they would have acquitted Craig Pennington of the charges of murder.
Correct. Yeah. His lawyer, who, for what it's worth, has no obligation to talk at this point. His client is dead. The case is closed. Said he issued a statement kind of on behalf of Pennington's other family, not the family that was at the house, but sort of his other relatives who didn't want their, Mr. Pennington to be painted in this way, and said that he maintained that he was innocent. Now, he also said that Pennington admits to participating in the cover-up and in hiding the bodies. So presumably, Mr. Pennington also knew who killed Crystal, or at least believed he knew who killed Crystal and Robert, but the attorney is still bound by attorney-client privilege and is not it does not feel like he's authorized to share that information at this point. And he now doesn't have a client to go back to share more information. So he's in a tight spot. But, if Pennington's version of events is true, that he just participated in cleaning things up, he presumably knew who the killer was and maybe died with that information, or maybe that information would never come out. It's a bizarre situation for sure.
So we know that the defendant here contracted the COVID virus while incarcerated and died of COVID-19. What do we know about why it's taken so long for this trial to move forward?
So it's a little hard to say. There was some prosecutorial misconduct, to use a $5 phrase, that basically there was some allegations that evidence was mishandled and things like that. That all adds time. Murder trials are notoriously long anyway, but there were some roadblocks in the way that delayed things further. And Pennington's attorney said it was actually the family that was there that night, which involved the teenager and his girlfriend, who were the biggest impedance to the trial. They, I guess several of them had moved to Washington State, and they were subpoenaed to come appear in court in the fall, and they managed they were able to get a judge in Washington State to quash the subpoena because of COVID concerns. They felt like it was unsafe to travel at this time during the middle of a pandemic, and they were a judge in Washington agreed with them and quashed the subpoena. So the prosecutors at that point, I suppose, would either have had to proceed without them. And they were, the teen was, a primary witness for them, I would imagine. Or they would have had to delay things further or wait for the pandemic to end, or who knows what their options would have been. But that definitely delayed things, according to Pennington's attorney.
We're talking to Cameron Knight, a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. You can read his full report on this story at cincinnati.com. And before we let you go, Cameron, you have another story out this week. It's a local case involving police and a couple of people who said some things on Twitter. And this case is headed to the Ohio Supreme Court. Can you set this up for us?
Yeah, so it's a portion of the case. Basically, there was an incident involving a Cincinnati police officer and some protesters over the summer at City Hall. A few protesters, one of them filed an official complaint against him, and a couple other people made comments online that he had made a racist gesture during this meeting. The police officer has sued several people involved in this thing. They say it's a defamation and that his hand gesture was simply an okay hand gesture. He didn't mean it in any other way, that he's not racist and that he is being defamed and targeted online and that he's having his privacy violated. So the police officer filed the lawsuit anonymously. Judge Shanahan, Megan Shanahan, in Hamilton County Common Pleas Court allowed him to file anonymously, essentially for the safety of him and his family, was her rationale. And she also, the judge also put a temporary restraining order on the defendants in the case, saying that they couldn't use any of the officers' personally identifying information, like they couldn't publicize it. Basically, they needed to stop talking about the guy online using his personal identification. So that small portion of this bigger case is being challenged. That temporary restraining order is being challenged by the defendant's attorneys, and the Ohio Supreme Court agreed to hear that question before them recently, and that part of it will go up there. So if the Ohio Supreme Court sides with the defendants, it could put an end to this temporary restraining order, and according to the defendant's attorneys, could potentially set a tone for the case, but it's not going to settle the case completely. It's just one part of this case that's being challenged in the Ohio Supreme Court.
Cameron Knight's reporting can be read at cincinnati.com. Cameron Knight, a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. Cameron, thanks for the time you gave us today.
Thanks so much. Have a good day.
You too. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Our news team here at the station recently added another new voice, one that is primarily focused on Cincinnati City Hall. So we'd like you to meet Becca Costello, who joins us now via Zoom. Becca, welcome to your first appearance, I think, on Cincinnati Edition.
Yes, it is. Hi, thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Well, we're so glad to have you. I don't have to pepper you with a whole lot of what you knew about Cincinnati before you arrived here, because you are really coming back here, right?
That's right. I grew up in Claremont County, mostly Williamsburg and Batavia, went to college in Cincinnati, and I've been out of state for about 5 years, but I am really happy to be back.
You know what matters is not where you went to college, it's where you went to high school.
Oh, well, that's a bit of a complicated question. So I was actually homeschooled until a little bit through high school. I spent just a couple of months at Batavia High School. And then I spent my last 2 years of high school at UC Claremont College. So a little bit of everything.
That's very cool. And so what attracted you to journalism?
Honestly, listening to WVXU. I grew up listening to the station and, you know, listening to NPR and thinking, hey, that's something I think I'd like to do. So when I ended up in Indiana to get a master's degree in journalism and headed straight to the local NPR station there and basically begged for a job. And luckily that kind of set me on the right path to come back here.
So you ended up in Bloomington, Indiana, and you were working at a station there?
That's right. Yeah. WFIU. And they were also the PBS member station as well.
And then prior to coming back home here and joining us at WVXU, you had another stop.
Yeah, I've been the last 2 years in Lincoln, Nebraska at NET Nebraska, and they were actually the statewide station. So we were news for all of Nebraska, both radio and TV.
Nebraska, which gave us Bill Reinhardt also.
Yes, that's right.
Did you know that?
I did know that. Yeah, we've had some fun conversations on Twitter before I ended up back here.
Bonding over Nebraska. I love that. So now you are joining us to primarily focus on local government, and you've been spending time watching Cincinnati City Hall. I don't think I've seen you in the building yet because we're still dealing with this pandemic, of course, and many of us are working remotely. I do look forward to the time that we can do that. But what are you learning so far about being thrown into City Hall? It's kind of a strange time to acquire that beat.
Yeah, what a great time to start a new job, completely remote, and also there's not much going on at City Hall, right?
Sure.
Yeah, just doing a lot of background reading. Obviously, I've got big shoes to fill with Jay Hanselman, who was covering city government for a very long time. But looking back on his reporting and all the other great reporting that's happening in Cincinnati has been super helpful, and just trying to figure it out as much as I can.
So you got to talk to Jay recently, right?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, did he have some good advice?
He had great advice. The best advice is to call him with questions, which I definitely plan to do.
He has strict orders on when we're allowed to call him, though, so I hope you follow that. And of course, we should remind people that Jay Hanselman left our station at the end of last year to take a job outside of the media, but he will occasionally pop in as a fill-in host, Hill, so we are looking forward to hearing his voice on the air again as well. Glad to hear Becca Costello's voice. Your voice is already being heard on our newscast, and you can read her work at WVXU.org. I already asked the high school question. I guess I have to ask, gosh, how do you eat your chili?
So I'm vegetarian, so I do three-way. I make my own chili at home with the spice packets, or I do Gold Star for veggie chili.
Awesome. Becca Costello can be read at WVXU.org. You can follow her on Twitter. It's just at Becca Costello, right?
Becca_Costello.
And you can find her tweets and takes there. Becca, thanks so much for joining us on this Friday. We look forward to talking to you about your upcoming reports.
Thank you so much.
Jenny's Ice Cream is a popular Columbus-based brand, which released a new flavor recently, raising eyebrows, questions, concerns, and hands of people who couldn't wait to taste it. It merges two popular food items that maybe you wouldn't have thought to combine: ice cream and an everything bagel. WOSU digital news editor Gabe Rosenberg tried it and reviewed it for Columbus Alive, and he joins us now to talk about it. Gabe, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you for having me on.
I'm so glad that you could join us. I've been pestering the Cincinnati Edition team here all week long about how I had to talk about this on the news review because it looks delicious. I haven't had a chance to try it yet. You did. I want to note that the headline in your review at Columbus Alive is "A Jew Reviews Jenny's Everything Bagel Ice Cream." And this is important, and I couldn't possibly articulate why, but bagels and the Jewish community, there's a connection there. And if you could just give us a quick elevator understanding of what that means.
Well, you know, I'm no bagel scholar, so I can't really tell you about, you know, the whole Eastern European or whatever origins of bagels. But, you know, Jews and bagels are like Americans and apple pie. So as you know, I grew up eating bagels pretty much every week in Temple, in my home. When I moved to Columbus, we have a number of great bagel places here. And, you know, I eat bagel maybe every other day for breakfast. So I'm pretty close to them.
So where does an everything bagel rank on the list of bagels that you choose to consume?
For me, everything bagel is sort of like the iconic bagel. You know, you've got your poppy seed, your sesame, your garlic, and your onion all in there. But like I said in my review, what really brings everything together in the everything bagel is the salt. You know, salt is really the key to unlocking all flavors. And in the everything bagel, it sort of adds that savoriness that makes you need to keep coming back. It also adds a little bit of texture, some crunch. And so that was really what I was looking for in the ice cream. Is an everything bagel ice cream going to be able to translate that texture as well as the flavor and the savoriness to what is traditionally a pretty sweet dessert?
Okay, so I guess the next question is, did it?
Honestly, pretty well. You know, I found out about the ice cream the other day, middle of the day, and as soon as work ended, I drove down the street to sort of my local Jenny's, grabbed a pint, drove back, and immediately stuck a spoon in. And, you know, it hits you in waves, really. You know, the ice cream is a cream cheese ice cream. It's got like this crumble of the everything bagel crumble in there. And, you know, at first taste, it sort of tastes like cheesecake. And then the onion hits you, you know.
And it's onion. The onion is involved in this too.
Yeah. So the crumble itself is onion and garlic and sort of a buttery streusel is what they call it. So the streusel and the ice cream by themselves, it would sort of just taste like New York cheesecake ice cream, which is, you know, not that far off from a regular ice cream. But the onion and the garlic, they hit you. And it's very confusing at first, but I sort of dug it. But for me, though,
little lacking in salt. So, you know, what I did is I took a little, you know, my little pinch jar of flaky sea salt. I sprinkled a little extra salt over on top of my ice cream, took another scoop, and it was perfect.
So you just had to add a little more salt to it.
I had to add a little bit more salt. I needed that umami, you know, I needed that, like, it was that little push that made me keep needing another spoonful and another spoonful. And I've eaten about, I'm still savoring the pint because, you know, I tried to go back 2 days later to buy a pint for a friend. They were sold out. So now I'm savoring my own pint and going through it slowly. But it did not disappoint. It was surprisingly great.
So we should note that this ice cream is described by Jenny's itself on the carton as cream cheese ice cream with everything bagel gravel. So this is a sweet and savory dish, I imagine.
Yeah. So the ice cream definitely is on the sweet side. The gravel brings that savoriness. I'm always a big fan of meeting that sweet and savory. You know, I really like salt added to desserts. You know, if you've ever had a chocolate chip cookie and then put a little bit of flaky sea salt on top, instantly 100 times better of a cookie than without the salt. And for me, this does something similar to the ice cream. I don't know if it's my favorite ice cream of all time, but, you know, pretty special experience. And you know what? I'd go back.
It's really that good.
It really is. It's also just something different. You know, you can't always, I mean, you can. My dad always goes to an ice cream place. He orders chocolate ice cream with chocolate jimmies. That is his order. But for me, I love the variety. I love trying new things. That's something that Jenny's does really well. I don't think it's my favorite ice cream at Jenny's. The cream puff ice cream will always be the tops for me because it really does taste like a German cream puff. But the Everything Bagel ice cream, you got to hand it to them. I think they really did something there.
And so this is the weekly news review. And I don't want this segment to sound like a commercial. But if you search on Google News for this Jenny's Everything Bagel ice cream, it's all over the place. People could not wait to try it. They were talking about it a lot. You said after you ran out and got a pint, you tried to go back to get more. They were already sold out. So in the Columbus area, you know, what was this? Was this a big deal when this new flavor was announced?
You know, I think it was shocking. It was one of those things where people were like, no, this is sacrilege. I will not stand for this. And I am someone who loves weirdness. I love weird flavors. I am down to try anything once. And so I knew that, like, I had to try it for myself. I had to. And as someone who loves Everything Bagels, you know, I am never going to say no to a bagel in some weird situation where you would think it wouldn't belong. I am happy to try any weird combination like that. And I think people are still out there shocked and awed, but I think there's a growing curiosity being like, oh, maybe I need to try this. So, you know, this is not an advertisement, but, if you get a chance, you know, it is worth it. It is surprising. It is fun. It is, at least something worth to share and talk about.
I should note that at the end of Gabe Rosenberg's review at Columbus Alive, he says, next time I might even try it with lox. WSU digital news editor Gabe Rosenberg, thanks so much for the time you gave us. You made us quite hungry, I think. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. And our technical director is Josh Elstro. I'm Michael Monks. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again on Monday.